Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, our guest is Marshall Poe. He's an historian, a writer, an editor, and founder of the New Books Network, which is an online collection of podcast interviews with like a wide range of nonfiction authors. I highly recommend it. He's taught Russian, European, world history at Harvard, Columbia, University of Massachusetts, and he's also taught courses on new media and online collaborations. In 2005, actually, and it's now defunct, but he founded the Memory Archive, which was really cool because it was kind of like Wikipedia for memoirs.
Yeah.
And it's like going to be a searchable, or was a searchable online database. The other thing, interesting connection with him and Wikipedia is that in 2006, he wrote this really cool commentary on Wikipedia, and it was like saying how Wikipedia is the coolest thing in the world, which I agree. But now, that was when he was editor at Atlantic Magazine. But now we can talk about AI and whether that's supplanting Wikipedia to a certain extent.
It's a good question.
Yeah. And then more as importantly, he wrote this incredibly researched book on the reality of the My Lai Massacre and the myth of the Vietnam War, which maybe we can touch upon because it'll be coming out in paperback fairly soon and will be stocked in the bookstore. So initially, we're going to be talking a lot about plagiarism in academia. And obviously, even though this is for a lay audience, pretty much everybody knows what's happened in the past few months with regard to the testimony in Congress and concept of context. And then the sequelae of what happened because of that. So what I would say would be like in a comprehensive question. So in light of this recent discourse, which surrounds the integrity of scholarly contact within these esteemed institutions, one, how do you perceive the mechanisms and the strategies that these places, these institutions that we admire, employ to mitigate and rectify these instances of intellectual misappropriation, if you will, amongst the faculty? And what further measures would you propose to enhance, if you will, the rigor of academic ethics?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think the first thing people who are not academics need to understand is that all of academia relies on trust to a degree that most people don't understand or recognize. Academics are trained not to plagiarize. We're trained to cite sources. In fact, there's every benefit from citing sources. It's a good thing to do. People like to be cited. And this is just a standard part of the way that we are trained. We know to do this. We know not to commit any sort of plagiarism and to cite sources and to quote effectively in our work. Everyone knows this. The reason I mentioned trust is that once you write an academic article or book, then it usually is submitted to a journal or a publisher, and they will vet it. And what that means is they'll have other experts look at it. This is what's called peer review. So they will find a couple of people, and they will send the manuscript anonymously. They won't have your name on it if the journal is well run. I used to run a journal, and this is the way we did it, to someone who knows the topic of the article or the book. And they'll say, evaluate this for us. Is it publishable? Does it make a contribution? And they will do that. This is also part of the burden that all academics have. We all review each other's work. And we try to do it in a fair-minded way. And the idea of the review is both to see whether it's publishable because it makes a contribution and improve it if possible. And I've gotten a lot of reviews of books and articles I've written where the reviewer, the peer reviewer, has suggested many good things that really improve the final product. And I was very appreciative of that. When I did it, I tried to do the same thing. What the peer reviewers do not do is check every citation and every quotation. That is impossible. They're simply, you know, in a book, you know, the book you just mentioned, the My Lai Massacre book, it's 300 pages and has 1,000 some footnotes. There's no way anybody could check that. It's just not possible.
Right.
And so the peer reviewers don't do it. And why don't they do it? Because they rely on trust. They trust that the scholar in question will not have plagiarized or will not have committed what I call idea theft. And there's good reason for this trust, I think, because we all work according to this code. It's a little bit like an example that I sometimes give that might appeal to the audience is it's a little bit like professional golf. Yes. There are no referees in professional golf. Did you know that? None. They police themselves. And it seems to work pretty well. Similarly, in academia, we police ourselves. Now, of course, if you do find a case in which something is erroneously cited or a quotation mark is missing, you're going to bring that to the attention of the author or the publisher. But you're not looking for that. You simply go in with the assumption that there's been no malfeasance. And, you know, in my 30 years in academia, I just can't think of instances in which plagiarism occurred with any of the things that I reviewed or certainly the things I wrote. Now, there's another thing that should be said about that. In an academic work of any size, you know, be it a 30-page paper or a 300-page book, there's a ton of information you have to deal with. And you're going to make mistakes. There's no question about it, because there's so much information involved. You're going to get a page number wrong. You're going to misspell somebody's name. You might forget a quotation mark. This is going to happen. I don't think it happens very often, but it's going to happen every time. I guarantee it. If you went through my My Lai book with a fine-tooth comb or some fancy AI, you'd probably find a place where I got the page number wrong or something like this. Or I missed a quotation mark or, you know, something that, you know, detracts from the overall sort of appeal of the book. But as I say, I don't think this happens very often. Again, in my experience, most academics are trustworthy because they know the rules. You do not benefit from plagiarizing. If you get caught, the penalties are dire, and we've seen that. So you do everything you can to avoid it. Let me say one more thing. Sure. And this is important. We don't know the rate at which it happens. This is an important empirical observation. We don't know how many academic articles and books have plagiarized material in them. There's no way to find out. Now, of course, you could spin up some fancy AI tool that did something, and that might be a good thing, but we just don't know. What we have is a few cases, and so we're generalizing from a very small N, a very small number. So when people say that it's rampant, they're thinking about four or five cases out of the hundreds of thousands of articles and books that are published every year. So we don't know how often it occurs.
It's funny, since you mentioned golf, and I'll mention another sports analogy. I always remember the story of Bobby Jones when he was in the woods and his ball was in the woods. There was no one else around. And then he came out of the woods and he said, "I touched the ball with the club." And it always kind of makes me want to cry, because it's such an honorable, courageous thing to do. Same thing. Now, okay, what would you do? What would you do if you were center fielder in the final game of the World Series, last out? Ball came to you. You thought you trapped it, but the umpire calls it a catch. You got 70,000 people watching you there, millions of people. Would you come up and go?
In a case where there's an umpire, you do what the umpire says. The umpire is the supervening authority. Although I do remember a case in which John McEnroe, he served and it was out, and the umpire called it in, and he went to the umpire and said, "Nope, that was out." But I think in a case like that, where you have an umpire, you do what the umpire says to do.
It's interesting. Here, now here's something. Remember I said at the beginning, you might get mad at me 10 minutes in. Here's 10 minutes in. So that first question, which I would have asked in other ways, that first question was generated completely by ChatGPT. So did I plagiarize?
No, I don't think so. You ask it the right prompts and then it came back with something useful. I mean, the skill is in the prompting.
Well, okay. So then let's switch to AI from your article back in the day. So I think I'm really good at framing a query, much better than pretty much anyone. And I've learned in the past year and a half, 2 years, I can frame a damn good query. And I did. And this is what it responded with, which is really no different than what I would have said, but I'm using word for word other than my and saying, oh, some of these, what do you call them, prestigious universities.
Yeah.
He is much more succinct than I. So you wouldn't consider that plagiarism?
I don't think it's plagiarism. No, it is produced by a non-human agent, but the prompt is the important thing. And no individual, that is a person in the eyes and the law of the law, that's the legal term, a person, produced this. So you weren't taking any person's intellectual property. If you were, if you copied the question from somebody else, then you should say, I got this question from Jane or Bob or whoever. But yeah. In this case, no, I don't, there's no person involved.
Yeah, but that goes to like the argument that people are making. Wait a minute, Harvard's code is holding its students to a higher standard than it is to its professors. So if a student copied from Wikipedia, then they're guilty of plagiarism because the works and the words in Wikipedia were generated by a human. But I bet you if you copied exactly from ChatGPT, that would be considered a violation if you were.
Yeah, they might say that. I don't know. I mean, the issue of the standard that students are held to and the standards that advanced professors are held to is it kind of an interesting one, and it's more subtle than most people think. I used to serve on a disciplinary board at Harvard. And yes, if we found instances of plagiarism, the student was penalized. Usually they were asked to take a semester off and think about their transgressions. Contemplate your sins, as my mom used to say. You know, in the case of a senior scholar, you know, what are you going to do? You've invested 25 years or 30 years in the training of this person. They're very highly esteemed in their field. They've made great contributions. And you find an instance in which they failed to include quotation marks where they should have. Are you going to fire them? Well, maybe, I guess if you're strictly going to apply the rules, you should do that. But I think it's better to chalk that up to a mistake. In other words, it has to be intentional. It really boils down to that. It has to be intentional plagiarism. Intention is a hard thing to prove, as you know. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, that if you do find a case in which someone plagiarizes serially, and it's obviously that they did it intentionally, they shouldn't be fired. They should be. It's bad for everybody. It's bad primarily because it erodes trust between scholars, scientists, and the public. The public needs experts. I know people trash experts all the time these days, but I don't know about you, but I don't do my own plumbing. I have a guy that does that. And similarly, you know, we need experts and we need to trust them. So when these instances of plagiarism come out, it erodes trust. And we've seen, of course, that Americans' faith in higher education has declined. That's partially as a result of this.
Well, I got mad at you because the Fox News article, in order to read it, I had to subscribe to the Fox News. I didn't want to subscribe. I was thinking, should I just not read it? But anyway, you have me. And you were talking about sin, and you said you would consider this venial. But that's still a sin.
It is, yeah. It's bad. These things are regrettable. They are bad. Everybody recognizes they are bad, whether they're unintentional or intentional. From a consequentialist position, to get a little fancy, it don't matter. The damage is done. And they're bad, and we should do everything we can to correct them. But this is another nuance. You know, in journalism, for example, journalists make mistakes, and it's a standard practice in journalism to do what? Well, issue a correction. Newspapers do this all the time. I've seen web pages with corrections. An earlier edition of this article erroneously said, academics have been doing this for 500 years. It's called an errata. And it used to be a standard part of a book. Like you get this page that they'd slap in at the end saying, here's some mistakes we found. You know, just FYI. And that's really, in the case of unintentional, you know, a kind of a screw up, that's what should be done, is that the material should be fixed. A note should be added saying this in an earlier iteration of this document, this was wrong. We have corrected it so that it's on the historical record. Because the idea ultimately is to get it right.
Well, the thing about this is the whole situation from the day of the testimony and the concept of context, which kind of kicked her in the butt too. Well, did. So, but then you realize this all these were used as a cudgel. And now you have this war, like with Ackman. So this never would have happened other than the fact that he decided, let me see how I can get back at her and force her to resign.
Right.
Ooh, I can go this way. And then, of course, yeah. Ackman's wife is accused of the same venial sin.
Right.
So now it's a war. And AI.
Well, that's a very unsavory part of it. You know, right. I can understand somebody going into an article or a book saying, you know, I think there might be mistakes here. We should correct these. I should contact the author. That's a good thing. You should do that. But picking people out that you don't like and you want to damage and then going over there to work with a fine-tooth comb, well, that seems a little, what is the right word for that? It's mean-spirited is what it is. If the intention is not to improve the work, the intention is to get the person. And I, you know, I don't know about you, but I don't go about my daily life to get people. I go about my daily life to help them. And so it seemed to me, what Ackman did seemed mean-spirited. And then in turn, what Business Insider, I think it was, did, was also mean-spirited. And so here we have a bunch of people acting in bad faith. Is this the kind of society we want to live in? I don't know, man. I don't. We're all going after one another.
Yeah, but in that, did you read that the New York Times article, the follow-up article called, what was it said, the title? The Word That Undid Claudine Gay. And it talked about context. And it said in all of its, the apologists at Harvard wrote all these 600-word texts. Well, actually, she did. President's message or whatever, but she never actually apologized for the testimony, nor did she use any proper nouns except the word Harvard. So she never mentioned Gaza or Palestine or Israel. And the article was basically saying that it's evidence of a bigger crisis in that Harvard basically was self-aggrandizing, notwithstanding that they were being attacked. So that was interesting to me because it was completely different than plagiarism, and it was as if, you know, things like we live in difficult and formidable times, difficult and troubling times, but it didn't specifically say or correct and say, you know, this does not, but if you believe it, this is not based on context, it's just the truth and we shouldn't tolerate it. And then the next day she kind of said, I misspoke. And everyone said, well, she hired a bunch of attorneys and the attorneys forced her to say this. It seems like a bunch of excuses to me, all three of them.
Well, yeah, I mean, at a certain point it became an exercise in saving people's reputations and not telling the truth. Now, the issue of context, which she mentions, is I think the thing that I objected to when she mentioned context in that congressional testimony was that she wasn't applying the standard equally. That it, when the issue was one that she favored, context was important. When an issue that she didn't favor was important, context wasn't important. And this is kind of central to kind of, you know, First Amendment free speech arguments, that these standards have to be applied equally. And I think what a lot of people said, and I think I saw this too in her testimony, that she didn't apply them equally. But I mean, she's not wrong. Context does matter, because if you live in a world with free speech, you know, it's very important to, you know, understand the context in which something is uttered. You know, like the classic example is whether you use an offensive word in quotes or not.
Right.
Right. If it's in quotes, it's not you saying it. You're quoting somebody. That's the context. But still, the word or phrase has been uttered. So what do you do in that case? Well, you have to say, well, the context matters.
Well, you know, there was a book by, I think it was George Trow. It was called Within the Context of No Context. And it was like, essentially described the terminal silliness of our culture. And whether you agree with the Republican woke concept, or whether you, or whether you're talking about Ackman, who's a Democrat, and you know, I immediately, my knee-jerk response, oh, he's a Democrat, he's a nice guy. You know, it's kind of weird what we've come down to. And yeah, so contextually, someone says Israel is horrible, and or the river to the sea. And that's meant to be, okay, we're going to, it's genocide, which is kind of what Netanyahu is, I shouldn't say that. Okay, never mind, I won't say it. But yeah, so what about that? I mean, it's like there is an absence of context, and that's the context of this absence.
Yeah, I think what I would say about that is that a part of the difficulty we have in dealing with these issues is we're dealing with them on places like Twitter. Twitter is not a good place to have a discussion about anything because it has no context and it limits the characters you can use. It's the opposite of the seminar room. Everybody is in there for a fight. Everybody is in there for gotcha. Everybody is in there to score points. You know, it's like junior high school.
And, yeah, but I've never used Twitter once. I have no reason to use it. I don't understand what it is. Yet the Pope has a Twitter account. Also, everyone hates right. Elon Musk, and they don't go off of Twitter. It's weird.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, people find it engaging, and there's no question. I used to lurk on Twitter until I decided it was bad for my mental health. But, you know, I wrote a book on the history of communications, and I can tell you that in many ways, Twitter is the worst possible form of communication. First of all, it can be anonymous. That's bad. Because we want people to stand by what they say as people. You know, second of all, it's fast. So you don't have time to deliberate. You can't think, huh, should I say that or shouldn't I say that? Also, there's no context. There's nobody out there. You don't see any people. When you're in a conversation with somebody, you get all kinds of cues about what they look like and how they're dressed and what the room feels like and so on and so forth. On Twitter, you have none of that. And you have this added business where you can score points. People can like your comment. Yeah. You know, it's a disastrous form of, it's the opposite of deliberative communication, where you sit down in a room with well-meaning people who know what they're talking about, and you're going to hash something out.
I remember on The Daily Show, when Stephen Colbert was a reporter, and he first said something about Twitter, and he goes, I tweeted today. And that was a joke. It was a joke. Yeah. He tweeted. And then... Right. Now that's accepted, just like so many things are accepted that, well, like the fact that Trump was elected president. I still can't believe that actually happened. I can't, you know, how many times have I said in the past 8 years, you can't make this stuff up?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things that I noticed in the past 8 years is that, and I used to work in journalism, I work at the Atlantic Magazine, there are entire stories now that are nothing but coverage of Twitter threads. That's incredible. There is no news there. Nothing in the real world happens on Twitter, but people are interested because, you know, the Pope called Elon Musk a jerk or something because he just didn't have his coffee and, you know, he just wrote something and right. And then there's a huge thread and it's a big kerfuffle and you know, but it's like, that's not news. It's not deliberation. We're not finding any solutions to anything. We're just yelling at one another. And I got very tired of it. And I turned off. Again, I never posted on Twitter, but I did lurk.
It's not just Twitter. We're living in an entire country where civil discourse doesn't exist. When did that happen and why?
Yeah, you know, I have a peculiar take on this. I don't think civil discourse has ever existed. And one of the reasons is, well, maybe it did among a certain group of people a long time ago. But since the 60s, and I know this because of the book I wrote about My Lai. For example, in the book, I cite many academics calling Lyndon Johnson Hitler. Like many of them. Like it wasn't a few, it was a lot. Is that civil? Not really. So the gloves have been off for a while in American discourse. And this is just a kind of later iteration of it. And people talk about, you know, we're more divided than ever. I don't know. In the period, I can't remember the exact statistic, but 1970 to 72, there were daily bombings in the United States. People forget this. Daily. And you can look it up. Daily bombings. There's a book about it, actually, called Days of Rage, which I highly recommend, about these groups that you routinely resorted to violence. They're blowing the Weather Underground's the one that's best known, but that there were a lot of other ones. And we don't have daily bombings anymore. But we did between 1970 and 72. So, yeah, I don't, more divided, less divided, I don't know. But yeah, I think the gloves came off in the 60s.
If we switch topics, what about what you said about anonymity on Twitter? What did you think of Ackman and the rest of those guys saying, let's find out who signed this letter so that we know who they are so we don't ever have to hire them?
That's also mean-spirited, and I don't particularly like that. But I tell my kids this, and I used to tell my students this. Don't ever do anything anonymously on the internet, ever. Because email is forever, Twitter is forever, Facebook is forever. Always attach it to your name. And what you'll find is, since you care about your reputation, you will police yourself if you're smart. Yeah. Because anonymity gives people a kind of license. It's like, you know, it's like you had four shots of tequila before you, you know, like it's a great disinhibitor. It's like, I can say whatever I want. They'll never find me. That's bad. You don't want to be exchanging information when people talking to people after four shots of tequila or under the cloak of anonymity, because you're going to say things that you wouldn't ordinarily say in your right mind.
Yeah. It's like my emails today. Well, not today, but present. I will write an email that is important, and then I just put it in drafts, and I go to sleep, and the next I look at it again.
Right, right. Don't respond immediately. Sit on it for a little while. Think about it. You know, we have ways of dealing with this. It's true with important conversations, too. You have to have an important conversation with your wife, your friend. You think about it for a while. You know, you don't just burst in there and say what you think. You have to kind of cogitate a bit about it. And then you speak once it's considered. But that's not what happens on Twitter at all. Nothing like that.
Yeah. And that leads to, again, back to AI and ChatGPT. And now there's tons of different ways of doing the same thing. And I'm not saying sentience will occur. But as we talked about, if you frame a query, you are an intelligent person. If you frame a query correctly, you get the response. You say it's not plagiarism, but many academics continue to denigrate ChatGPT, saying it's not smart, it's stupid. Well, it's smarter than they are because it knows a lot more than they do. You ask it about the Civil War, it's going to know more than any professor of Civil War history. And they refuse to acknowledge that. And they go, well, it's good for emailing. One of them said, a dentist I know emails his staff things. And I'm thinking, how incredibly stupid can you be to think that's someone really smart theoretically who said that? What do you see it doing? What do you see it doing in the coming years? I mean, I think you could go to school and not have a teacher and have, if they could ever come up with a actual android of sorts, standing in the front of the room. Any question that you asked, any question could be answered intelligently, succinctly, and lead to more topics.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of raw information, which you just might call data, yeah, these things are very good. In the same way Wikipedia was good. It's pretty good. It's not great.
Where's your but?
Well, there's a but because Wikipedia is written by, and this is an important point. I mean, we live in a society that really prizes individualism. We you know, have kind of enthroned the individual, the sovereign individual, you and me. Wikipedia is written by anonymous editors. We don't know who they are. You can't be traced back to them. That's bad. Similarly with ChatGPT, it seems to come from nowhere. It can't be traced back to a person. And ultimately, I think what we're interested in is people. You know, that's why on the New Books Network, we take a very direct route to this. We interview authors about their new books. You hear from the author. There is no intermediary. You hear directly from the experts. You hear their voice. They say what they want. If you have a beef with them, you can contact them. You can talk to them. If ChatGPT gives you an answer you don't like, what are you going to do? I don't know. You know, on Wikipedia, you can go argue with the editors, but I've done that personally, and that's really quite fraught. But, you know, I think we're interested in individuals, in actual people, in what used to be called the meat space. And this is extremely important in terms of what we do with whatever information we get, however we get it, because it's people that are going to be deciding these things, and it's people's lives that will be affected.
Well, aren't we kind of like dinosaurs? Because you look at kids today, and when they text or write, they say you, Y-O-U, they say it with you, or four is the number four. And my nephew texts me and I said, you got to correct these errors. And he goes, why? Did you understand what I said?
Well, I said, you know, that's a point. Your nephew has a point.
And they use emojis, and they, why should I learn math? I can ask any of these questions. What's the point of me learning this when I can simply ask the question, why use my brain when I can use my brain for something else? So aren't we like dinosaurs? And progress is this. This is progress.
Well, yeah. I mean, you can think about, you know, one analogy that occurs to me when I think about AI is, what's an early form of AI? Well, it's the calculator. You're old enough to remember when they first appeared. I am. And I was like, this is the greatest thing, man.
Yeah, HP's reverse Polish logic.
Yeah, man, these things are great, you know, and because I didn't have to try to tax my brain to do complex calculations. The calculator would do it for me. And I was like, this is just wonderful. And it speeded my work up. You know,
I had a slide rule.
Well, sure. Yeah. I learned to use a slide rule too, actually. I learned to use a slide rule in junior high, which I guess is also AI of a sort. But yeah, these are tools that will help us answer questions. What we do with those answers is the question. And that involves humans, inevitably, because we're interested in humans. I always think of these things as just tools, like a hammer is a tool. It's good for like hammering nails and things like this and pulling nails. And ChatGPT is a tool. And we're going to use it for various purposes, get information. And then we're going to take that information into, you know, the real world where it'll have consequences.
Yeah, but it's like Sam Altman and Elon Musk say it's going to destroy the world. It's more dangerous than climate change. And you know, when people say save the world, the way to save the world is to eliminate one species, us. The world would do a lot better without us being here. And theoretically, AI is going to say, you know, something screwy about all this stuff. Oh, yeah, it's people. We don't need them.
I would say it's fair. I mean, well, I wouldn't say that because what we really care about is people. I mean, I don't know about you, but me. I won't speak for anybody but me.
Does a hammer care about a hammer?
No, the hammer doesn't care about a hammer, but AI might care about AI, and we got to be careful about that. Yeah, I see your point. But yeah, ultimately, what we're interested in is people, and what we're interested in is having tools that are safe, right? And so we want to make AI safe. How to do that, we don't know. We're going to try to figure it out. We may succeed, we may not. I don't know. But, you know, our track record in kind of assimilating new tools is pretty good. We know how to do a lot of really dangerous things.
Yeah, but
we use them for mostly good purposes.
Biden has appointed Kamala Harris to be the czar of saving us from AI. And that to me is like so silly, because there's no way she could even understand the beginnings of AI, because she's dumb and she can't.
Well, but I'll tell you where it will all be figured out.
Where?
I'll sound like a Chicago economist now. It'll all be figured out in the market. And because there are already companies in my own business, I run a podcast network. In my own business, I get thrown all kinds of AI tools all the time. And some of them I like, and some of them I don't, and some of them I pay for, and some of them I don't. Some of them I find, kind of morally repulsive. So I don't do those. And essentially it will be worked out in the market. Because ultimately AI has to be turned into, everything has to pay for itself. Your bookstore has to pay for itself. The New Books Network has to pay for itself. The AI companies have to find a way to essentially monetize what they do. and they'll figure it out. And they'll produce a bunch of really useful tools that we'll be using in our daily life.
Yeah, but look at Amazon, like wiping out the IGAs, which I remember when I was a kid, and they were really nice because they provided service and you knew the person.
Yeah.
And or like when the candle makers, all of a sudden light bulbs came out and they go, they're really dangerous. But candles are more dangerous. And now there's not candles, except for the fact that people like candles, but there's no reason for candles to exist. No. Things move on and technologies move on. And you say market, okay, Amazon has created the market. Whether you like it or not, people hate Amazon. I read a book about a guy who wrote How to Fight Amazon, and his book is published on Amazon.
Yeah, sure it is. But I mean, I think, you know, again, being a historian sort of helps here. We think of these companies as now and forever, but they're not. You know, you look at the early auto industry or the early oil industry, it looked like Standard Oil was forever, but it wasn't, you know, and it looked like GM, which had been bailed out about a zillion times, was forever, but it wasn't. Similarly with all of these companies, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, they will be competitors that will displace them. If that doesn't happen, it will have been the first time in the history of capitalism. And that shit doesn't happen. There are people who are figuring things out. Well, just like this for an example. I had this idea the other day. If you have a really good ChatGPT, why do you even need a search engine?
Yeah, that's a good
point. I want to, you know, I'll be like, what's the address of the Wellington Square bookshop? ChatGPT is just going to tell me. I don't need to go search the web. Or what keyword should I use? There are a bunch of things called Wellington. I have to spend 20 minutes. Oh, that's it. It's not that Wellington bookshop. It's this Wellington bookshop. But ChatGPT just tells me, just like that, right? So why do I need a search engine? I just need that, you know. And this is like an existential threat to Google, and they know that, because when it's that good, you know, tell me about, you know, if you typed in, tell me about Marshall Poe, it'd probably give you a pretty good bio. What do you need Wikipedia for? You got that. And again, since, you know, especially for Google, since all of its revenue comes from advertising, I don't know what's going to happen to Google when ChatGPT is so good that you don't really need a search engine anymore.
Kind of pissed off at Jeff Bezos and his soon wife because it's so disgusting. But one thing he did that was really cool is he gathered everyone together. He got in trouble for this. He gathered all of his employees together and he go, we won't be around 25 years from now.
He's right.
Yeah.
Well, he's a smart guy. He's right. They won't. And well, they'll both be dead, and Amazon won't exist anymore. Something like it will exist. But no, these things, you know, you should never underestimate the ability of people to, especially Americans, to be innovative. Like every time, like I remember, I'm sure you remember this. I remember when people, this was the 90s, when people who were early Apple fans, and I was one of them, were like, it's over for Apple. Microsoft, and there were congressional hearings about Microsoft being a monopoly, and, you know, and I remember seeing memes before there were memes where Bill Gates was Darth Vader, and right. Well, what happened with that?
I bought my first Mac in March of 1984 with Steve Jobs' signature on the inside of the case. And and then Microsoft essentially stole the interface.
Yeah, the GUI interface, yeah.
Yeah, and the patent office said, well, you can't steal a look and feel. Right. And they should never have gotten Windows.
But I mean, my point is that, you know, people had Apple on its deathbed. And now look at Apple. It's like the second largest company in the world.
Yeah, when Michael Dell said he'd buy it for $500 million before Steve Jobs came back.
Yeah, right. Right. So you can't tell exactly how long these companies are going to be providing the services that they're especially in the era of AI, because we don't know what that's going to do to the business processes involved.
Well, you can switch from AI to cyber currencies. Warren Buffett said the other day that he wouldn't give 25 cents for all the cyber currencies in the world.
Well, yeah, that's another one. Yeah. I mean, that's another one. We don't know where that's going either. I mean, I don't understand cyber currency personally, because I don't understand the use case, except to buy drugs. It's very useful in buying drugs, but other than that, I don't get the use case because nobody takes
Oh, what if you
it.
had a pound, what if you had a kilo of gold? You carried it around with you. What are you going to buy with the kilo of gold? Who's going to accept it? And what if you're just going to buy a pack of gum? You just take a knife and slice off a piece of the gold. You
Yeah,
can't
no, you
use
can't do
gold.
that. No, that's
You
not
can't
going to
use
work.
gold, so what's the difference, really? It's a
Yeah.
what are they? It's just a store of value.
Well, it's a
That's
store of value, but this one's very volatile. Gold is not very volatile. Gold
no,
is
not
what's
at
called
all.
Lindy. It's been around forever and it's not going away. Whereas cyber currencies, first of all, there's rampant fraud in cyber currencies, rampant.
Yeah,
And
there is. But I would disagree
because
with you. I don't understand it simply because I don't understand what a blockchain is. I don't know what a blockchain
it's a
is.
kind of accounting, that's all it is. I mean, I don't, it's a kind of accounting. But I'm sure that there's some use for this that is beyond buying drugs. But the people that I know who've talked to me about it say that it's really primarily used for illegal transactions because it's anonymous. It's truly anonymous. You really can't find out who did it. And in that way, it has value because you can't do that kind of business in dollars. If you do, the Fed will be all over you.
Yeah, but
So.
what if we're wrong? You and I think, just my opinion, are kind of like dinosaurs. I think we're be I always thought I'd be ahead of the curve, and I'm not ahead of the curve anymore. The wave just crested, and I'm behind it now.
I agree with you. I am not ahead of the curve. There's no question about it. I like books and I like to read books and talk to people about books. My kids don't do those things. Well, they do read books, actually. They read a lot of books. My kids love books.
All right.
But they also love YouTube. And and I didn't have that. But then again, when I was a kid, I loved television. What's the diff? I don't know. I do think that, it's a period of great transformation, but I'm a pretty optimistic person. I think that we'll figure it out how to use these things effectively.
Right. Well, I jump around all the time for good or for bad. But if you take climate change, for example, you're an optimistic person. I don't see any possible way that we can forestall what's happening with India and China and the fact that even electric cars use lithium batteries that are created in electricity generating plants that inject carbon into the atmosphere. And I don't see anyone, when Trump is elected, assuming he'll be elected, which I'm assuming he'll be elected, will be out of the Paris Accord again. And people fly to these meetings in private jets using more carbon than they're ever going to save,
Yeah,
whatever happens.
I think that,
You're optimistic
again,
about
I
it?
sound like a Chicago economist. I think the market will figure this out. I mean,
How?
somebody, well, for example, somebody that invents a really efficient, high capacity, easily disposable battery. Now, I don't know who's doing it, some material scientist somewhere, but if they invent that, that's like a game changer.
Yeah,
And that,
we already have
but,
that. Nuclear power plants are that, but
well,
because this political and social idea that they're incredibly dangerous, which in my opinion, they are not dangerous at all.
well, I happen to agree with you on that, and I think that a lot of our problems could be solved in the short term, and I'm short, I mean decades, by increasing the capacity of nuclear power plants. This
Okay.
just seems to me to be obvious, like so obvious you don't even know. You can't believe it's not being done, because we're pretty good at nuclear power. There are statistics about the number of people that coal-fired plants and nuclear power plants have killed, and coal-fired plants have killed hundreds of thousands of people. Because of all of the sequelae of, sucking up all the stuff that they put out.
Coal
Nuclear
mines.
power plants have killed like 30 people.
50
Like,
people in Chernobyl, no one in Three Mile Island.
yeah,
Which
like
is
it's it, is it safe? What the fuck? What's safe? I don't know anything that's safe. I mean, is it safer than the alternatives? Probably. And would it supply a lot of electricity? Yeah, it really would. Do I think we have the capacity to deal with all of the what's it called, waste that they produce? Yeah, I think we do.
we do.
I do think we do. Yeah, and I think it would be a good bridge. And
I
I
didn't
don't
really think
understand the fear of nuclear power either.
I didn't I didn't really think that I'd be preaching to the choir. I thought we'd have an argument about this, but it's
no. I don't. I never have understood this at all. And
I'm gonna send this to this guy. I had this. We were arguing with a bunch of people about this, and everybody had a knee-jerk response to it. And he and I agreed completely. We almost the same conversation you and I just had. And then we looked around and we realized everyone disagreed with us.
Yeah, well, you know, it's about a lot of it is about teaching people. And there are people out there teaching people that nuclear power, you know, it's not safe. Nothing's safe. Like walking out your door is not safe, but it's safer than the alternatives. And it is quite efficient. We know how to do it. It doesn't involve a lot of new technology. You know, well, but speaking of that, what happens when fusion comes online?
Jeez.
That's a total game changer. You know, maybe it never will come online. I don't know. We've been working on it for 50 years. But, you know, sometimes things take a long time to figure out. And if that comes online, well, then, you know, great. Like, we're pretty much done in terms of energy production.
And the market will decide. Cold fusion, if it ever comes about.
Well, right. Any kind of fusion at scale would be produced in a... I mean... If you invented that, you would be the richest person in the world in about a week.
How do we started with plagiarism? We were going to talk about that. Now we're all over the place. Now
well, that's like going to that's what I always say about Wikipedia when it was early in the early days. You start by looking something up, like, yeah, I want to know about the history of the Boston Red Sox, and then you end up on a page about Ukrainian tractor production, and it's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did I get there? What?
Yeah, my wife wonders why I'm researching for this interview, and then why am I dealing with the store Anthropology and where it gets his dishes from?
I mean,
that's 3 hours later.
That's the mark of a curious mind. You should be listening to the New Books Network or going to Wellington Square Bookshop.
That would be great. Well, yeah, I could just listen to each of these. But then again, you know what? I'm putting these books on my front table, but where's my audience? I mean, I don't mean that like no one's going to buy your book, but they're going to buy beach reads. And, you know, it drives me crazy.
Yeah, it doesn't drive me crazy anymore. I mean, you know, what I say about the value of a book is you never know when you're going to need it.
Correct.
And so here's an example. So I was an expert in early modern Russian history. I spent 20 years studying it. And that's the period between about 1450 and 1700. Very obscure.
Yeah.
Americans can't say anything about early modern Russian history. And it seems totally irrelevant. But then all of a sudden, Vladimir Putin writes an essay and gives a speech in which he talks extensively about it. And suddenly I'm valuable. And people are calling me. He's like, hey, you're the guy who knows about this. Is what he's saying true? I'm like, well, yeah, actually some of it is and some of it isn't, and so on and so forth. And so we can kind of have a meaningful dialogue about what Putin said. Similarly, with any book, you don't know exactly when its time is going to be. It's a kind of permanent contribution to the culture. You know, the Milai book is an interesting, you know, I started the Milai book 12 years ago. And I got a lot of interest in it because of the Hamas attacking on the Israelis. Because that was an atrocity, right? And we need to know about how atrocities occur. And so people called me and said, you know, can you talk a little bit about how these things occur? And I was able to do that because I had studied the My Lai massacre and I knew about how it occurred. And I was able to inform the debate in that way. But, you know, that may have been the moment for that book. I mean, there may not be another moment for 10 years, but there'll be other atrocities. And then they'll call me again.
You know, it's funny because when I started reading the book before, I looked at the title and it says The Reality of the Milai Massacre and the Myth of the Vietnam War. And I go, I wonder which way this is going. I wonder if he's going to be a Republican apologist and say the massacre never occurred. Or if he's, you know what I mean? It's like you're his historian, but you're looking at a period in Russia where, you know, cliche, history is written by the winners. And, you know, where's the objectivity that you're looking for? So the title is like, okay, I could go both ways. Maybe he's going to say that Kali was not, you know, an evil person, but was just placed in the wrong place at the wrong time and was used as a scapegoat. I thought, okay, maybe it's going to come that way, you know?
Well, I mean, you mentioned objectivity, and I'm a big fan of objectivity. And when historians, if they are taught correctly, and I think they are in the United States, they're taught to be objective. They're taught to approach the material without bias. And that's what I really tried to do. Now, if you talk to philosophers, they'll say that the idea of objectivity is pretty much indefensible. Everybody has a take. Okay, I'll grant that. But I always think of this about objectivity. Objectivity may not exist, but we're really going to miss it when it's gone. In the sense that, like, we know places where it really was thrown out the window. Soviet Russia, Nazi Germany. And that is a kind of cautionary tale.
Yeah, but as a lawyer who's been practicing for 40 some years, I always like the cases before the Supreme Court where it's a 5-4 decision, but the majority says reasonable minds could not disagree on this issue.
Yeah.
It's a 5-4 decision.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's a little rhetorical flourish, kind of exaggerated. Yeah.
But anyway, okay. So in conclusion, going back to the precept of the entire interview and ChatGPT's question, here we are in the middle of this thing. No longer makes headlines right now. She's out. She's essentially apologized. The other one's out. There's one left. So where do we go? And Ackman is still pushing and saying he's going to review every single professor's.
I haven't thought deeply about this, but what I would say that if Bill Ackman wants to improve the quality of American education, which is a laudable goal, and he has a huge pile of money to do it,
he does.
This would not be money well spent. There are other things he could use his money for, which would have a lot greater benefit for ordinary students and people than to go check the footnotes of a bunch of people like me. Who knows what he'll find? But call me naive, but I trust my colleagues. I don't think they're bad actors. I think they try to get it right. And so investing millions and millions of dollars to somehow check to see whether they included a quotation mark? I don't know. I mean, they're failing inner city schools. The math scores are down. There's lots of work that needs to be done in American education that could use appropriate funding. And I would love it if Bill would like spend some money trying to fix that problem, pay teachers more. I don't know. I'm not an expert on education, but I do know there are problems. But checking professors' footnotes? This will sound a little bit too self-effacing, but like, what if every academic article and book I had written disappeared tomorrow? How would the world be different? Not very. Not very different. So spending a lot of time on my work, I don't think that's really going to give good value for money.
Have you ever spoken to Ackman?
Oh, no, I don't know him. No, I don't know anybody like that.
I heard him on CNBC making an argument about what he did, and it was fairly articulate and cogent. It would be interesting for you to have a debate with him. I'd love to talk to him.
You know, if he really does want to improve American education, there are lots of things to do. And people who are in the education field know what they are. Like, it's not like this stuff hasn't been studied and there aren't lots of experiments going on. So, yeah, I mean, maybe graduate students should be trained better. I don't know. Maybe it is the case that they're not being trained not to plagiarize anymore. I very much doubt that. But if you want to combat plagiarism, teach people not to do it.
Well, normally my last question would be, what do you want people to take away from this book? But it's not a book. It's just a position that's been articulated in various periodicals. So if I look at it that way and ask the same question, and you've done this in this interview, what would you like people to take away from your viewpoint as written and as articulated today?
Yeah, I think that when you pick up an academic book, a book published by a scholarly press or a university press, you can be pretty sure that 99.9% of the information in it, including all the technical details, is correct. Because we work hard to make these things right. I mean, I can't tell you the blood I sweated over the books I've written. I mean, it's really a We don't make any money from these books. I don't know if people know that, but I don't think I'm going to make a dime from that Mealy book. But I thought it was an important thing needed to be said. And I did everything I possibly could to get everything right. And that's painstaking work. That's the way I was trained. And I think that most academics are trained like that.
Yeah, and I don't own a bookstore to make money because I'm not going to ever make money owning a
Well,
bookstore.
right. Yeah. I mean, some things you do just because they're good things. And we're fortunate and privileged in the sense that we can keep body and soul together and do those good things.
I never take that for granted, and I figure if I can have people come into my bookstore and be happy and laugh, and my staff happy and laugh, and a kid comes in and looks for a book, but he sees the book on either side, and one of those books might change his
That's
life.
a great experience.
I can't think of anything better.
That's a great experience. I've had it many times. That's a beautiful experience.
That's a good way to end, Marshall. Thanks so much for doing this today. I really
All right.
appreciate
No, it's really been fun. I really enjoyed our conversation.
it.
Thanks.
Likewise.